I call your attention tonight to Matthew 13. We've been there a minute, and we'll probably be there maybe one more Wednesday night, and then we'll move on to some other parables. But of course, there are about seven parables, I think it is, in Matthew 13. And overall, there's probably 37, 38 of them that's in the New Testament. And we will try to cover every one of those. And tonight, this is the 13th week that we have been talking about the parables of Christ. That means for 3 months, we have been in this series. And it seems like that we're going to be in it another 4 or 5 months. And so I want you to look with me beginning in verse 47 this evening. It says, "And again, the kingdom of heaven is like unto a net that was cast into the sea and gathered of every kind." Verse 48, "Which when it was full, they drew to shore, sat down and gathered the good into vessels or containers. But the bad, or they but cast the bad away." Verse 49, "So shall it be at the end of the world. The angel shall come forth and sever the wicked from among the just, and shall cast them into the furnace of fire, and there shall be wailing and gnashing of teeth." Now, the previous two Wednesday nights, I have preached on the treasure and the pearl. Well, actually, that's not true. I preached on both of those last week. I combined those. And so the treasure, though, is Israel. The treasure's hidden. It's hidden in the field. What do we know from the early parables that we looked at when it talked about the sower sowing seed? Where did the seed get sown? It got sown into the world. So we know that the field where the treasure was hidden is the world, and the treasure itself that is in that field is the nation of Israel. Now, there are people, and they look at the nation of Israel, and they don't really even think about that nation very much. One of the things that bothers me, though, is when they do think about the nation of Israel, they're thinking about Israel in a derogatory way. I mean, you've got the whole Middle East, and in the whole Middle East, you've got one government that is a democratic form of government, that is Israel. And I don't know if the world knows this or not, but there are even Palestinians that get to vote in Israeli elections. And yet Israel is accused of committing a genocide. And so this nation is the treasure that is hidden. But the second thing that I talked about last week was the pearl of great price. And that was the church. And so we saw that the pearl, it began to grow, and it became great. And so we have the pearl. We have Israel the treasure, the church is the pearl. But tonight we're going to look at something that does not have to do with Israel per se or the church per se. We're going to be looking at a net that is cast into the sea, and we're going to see what that is in reference to. Now, we know that the parable that we looked at, that was the wheat and the tares, we know that the outcome was very similar to this outcome. In both of those parables, what do you have? You have the angels that are doing basically the punishing as far as being tossed into the fire. We see that. And so it's similar to that this evening. And both of the wheat and the tares and the drawing of the net, both of those parables really kind of encompass the main themes here in chapter 13. Now, I want us to look at three things tonight. Now, we've got a business meeting, and so I'm going to go a little quicker than I normally would this evening, because we do have three quick things to vote on for the coming year. Number one, I want you to think about the catching of the fish. Catching the fish. Look with me at verse 47. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like unto a net that was cast into the sea and gathered of every kind. Now, when you read the Bible, there are a couple of different kind of nets that you find. If you've been around water at all, you probably know what type of nets that I'm referring to. There are times when you have what is called a throw net or a casting net. It's kind of a bell-shaped type netting. It may have a few little sinkers on the bottom of it so that when you sling it, it goes down and kind of comes together and kind of binds at the bottom. A few years ago, we took our family to Mississippi. We rented a house in Mississippi over about 30 miles outside of Biloxi. No, we didn't hang out at the casino. We were there in this little area. We had this nice little house. I don't know if you know this, but the Mississippi beaches are not that nice. Muddy shores. We're not talking the sandy beaches of Florida, all right? But it was a good time. And one of the things that we did was on, I guess, the third day that we were there, I rented a boat. Now, I wasn't driving the boat because I didn't want to get lost out there on the water. But we rented a boat to go fishing. I took my son and I took a couple of kids. One of them was my grandson, Carter. He had a little buddy of his named Noah. And then me, and then we had the captain. So there was like five of us in the boat. And so we were going, and this guy goes, well, I got to stop and get gas. I'm thinking, what kind of captain doesn't already have this thing filled up? All right? We get out on the water, and he goes, we got to go get some bait. And I'm thinking, this guy is not organized. Now, he's just a kid, all right? He's when I say a kid, he's probably in his 30s, all right? I know he wasn't 40. And so he said, I think I know where I can do some casting. So he gets a casting net out, gets up on the front of the boat, and he slings that thing, and it goes out kind of like a frisbee and lands. He lets it go down, and then he begins to pull it. He didn't catch anything. I mean, not a thing. He did that two or three different times. Finally, he goes, I think we need to go to a shrimp boat and get some what is called bi-bait, like B-I, like more than one kind. So they're kind of catch shrimp, but in those shrimp nets, they catch other type of fish. So it's called like two kinds of bait or whatever. And so finally, we were able to get some fishing bait. So we went out and we did well. It was midnight when we got there. We caught red snapper, and every one of the ones that we caught was over 20 pounds. I mean, it was huge. Great, great fishing. But the net that he used was a throw net that one person could throw. The second kind of net that is mentioned in the Bible is like a drag net. All right? And I don't know why, but my wife is getting hooked on Dragnet, the TV program, all right? Sometimes when she's going to go to bed, she'll say, turn on Dragnet for me. And so we have, Sergeant Joe Friday on there, and he's catching the bad guys. Well, there's a Dragnet that's not for detectives, but it's for fishing. My grandfather, one of the things that he liked to do was go to the Ottumwa River. And it's a huge river that basically emptied into the Atlantic Ocean. And certain times of the year, usually kind of like this time of year, it would begin and it would go through kind of January. And that's when there would be a fish that would be coming back upstream called shad. And some of you that have been fishing before, you know that that shad, they're kind of like, as far as their migration, they're kind of like salmon going upstream, all right? And he would go down to a place outside of Ludowice called Beard's Bluff, and he had a seine that was like 150 feet in length. And he would either go himself and he would swim out in that cold water or send one of his boys out, and there would be one that would hold it on the shore, and they would hold it out treading water, and then they would begin to swim, and they would begin to go downstream, and they would come, and finally they would get, and they would pull it back, and they would make a loop, and then they would get the shad out of that seine. That's the picture that I want you to see here as far as catching the fish. It's just where, for sure, one boat that would be moving along. Sometimes, according to Linsky, the net could be up to a half a mile in length. And all I'm thinking is, if those nets are a half a mile on the Sea of Galilee, man, that's a pretty big swath for the Sea of Galilee, which is about 12 miles in length, and I think it's about 7 miles wide. I mean, you're talking about a half a mile. That's 1/14 of the width of that thing. I mean, you think about if you cut your grass and you had 14 swaths and you got it done. All right? I mean, that's pretty quick. And so you've got that type of net. Sometimes it would be connected between two boats. Do you remember the story in John 21 where Jesus said, cast the net on the right side of the boat, and they had to compel the other boats to come help them because the net was so full? They had multiple boats that were helping to get the net to shore. And so we see the catching of the fish. Now the second thing that we see is what I'm calling the culling of the fish. Now, culling is that's a southern word, all right? My family, they grow onions. Vidalia onions. Some of you have gotten those bags from us. Every year for the last, I think, 8 or 9 years, I've gone down to South Georgia in the springtime, and I've bought anywhere from 50 to 70 bags of onions, and I bring them back, and I try to give them to the people in the church. Just a way to let you know that we love you, and if you like onions, we try to get you some. But one of the things that I'm always fascinated at is in their grading process, they will have the jumbos, and they will have the large, and they'll have the mediums, but they have a bunch of small ones that they just basically throw away. And I'm thinking, that's a good size onion right there for a one meal. I mean, you could season all kind of stuff with that little baby onion. That's one of the reasons why I always get the mediums, is because it's less waste. Sometimes you cut a jumbo, you don't use but half of it, and then the next thing you know, it's in your refrigerator for 2 weeks, all right? And so, but they take those little baby onions, and they call them culls. And they'll take them, and they'll just throw them out in the woods. And I'm thinking, I wish they wouldn't do that. You know, I mean, I could find somebody to let them have those things. But in their minds, they're like, we're not here to save everything. We're here to make money. And evidently, they know what they're doing. They've been doing it for almost 40 years. And so, anyway, there is a culling, which means that you are severing, all right? Now, look with me at 48, and we'll begin there. And it says, which, when it was full, they drew to shore, sat down, gathered the good into vessels. They had probably baskets. That would have been their way to transport the good fish. Now, the fish that they normally eat out of the Sea of Galilee, we would call tilapia. Sometimes they don't cook it the way we would like it, all right? 2013 was the first time that I went to Israel. One night, they were giving us what is called St. Peter's fish. And when I looked at that, I'm thinking, that don't look good. And I tried to taste it, and it didn't taste good. You had that whole fish that was there with his eyeball looking at you. And it was kind of like, me and St. Peter, we're not getting along with our, you know, taste buds with fishing. But a couple of years later, I went with Brother Sexton. And he goes, "We're going to have St. Peter's fish." And I'm thinking, goody. That's what I'm thinking. But this time, they didn't just kind of grill it halfway. They literally fried it the way God intended it to be. And so they fried it, and it was good and well done. And I loved it. It was so good. But it's tilapia. I asked him, I said, how would this equate to something in the States? And they said, tilapia. And I'm looking forward to probably having it again at some point in our next trip, as long as they fry it. And so they are catching these fish, but now they're sitting down and they're beginning to divide them. They're severing them, to use the word. Now the disciples, they're understanding this picture. The reason I know they're understanding this picture is because probably six of them, at least of the 12, were probably fishermen. You say, how do you know that? Well, we know that Peter and Andrew were fishermen. We know that James and John were fishermen. We also know that in John 21, when Peter basically quit the ministry, according to Kenneth Wiest, who is the foremost Greek scholar that I've ever known, he said, when Peter said, "I go a fishing," that meant that he quit basically trying to be in the ministry. He was so embarrassed by the fact that he had denied the Lord. "I'm a failure. I can't do anything. I'll go fishing. I know how to make a little money fishing." Well, the text says that there were six disciples, and they said, "Well, we're going fishing with you." So in other words, he has now influenced six other men. Probably the majority of those guys would have been guys that had used to be fishermen. And so you have this culling that they would see that in their minds. But this culling here is not really for them. He just wants them to understand what is going to take place when the culling actually begins, because he is telling them that they're going to cast the bad away. So what does that mean? That means that when they were going through those nets, if there was a little small tilapia that was too little, they would toss him back into the water. But if it was some fish that nobody cared for, they may toss that over into a pile, and they may give it to somebody in agriculture, and it could have been maybe for fertilizer. There's a man and his wife that swear by fish fertilizer, not the liquid, but an actual fish that I have seen on some videos. They're out of Florida. Every year they go and they catch, we call it white perch in South Georgia, all right? Up here they call it crappie. I hate that name, so we call it white perch, all right? And so they catch these, they freeze them, and in the springtime when they are planting their gardens, in the tomato holes, cucumber holes, all of that, they dig a hole that's a little deeper, and they put a fish in the hole, put a little dirt on it, a little lime on it, a little fertilizer in it, and then they plant. I'm going to be honest with you, the guy's got some pretty good-looking stuff, right? It's prettier than mine, you know, and it's me. I just use Miracle-Gro, you know, and or, you know, chicken stuff. And so, anyway, it may be that they toss this aside. How many of you even know what a shiner is? Okay, a couple of you, all right? I used to hate those things when I was fishing in those South Georgia ponds. And I wouldn't throw them back. If I caught one of those jokers, he went in the woods. The raccoons or the possums could have him. He wasn't going back in the water. I'm thinking, that trashy fish ate my bait. He ain't going back in the water. Well, the bad they cast away. And also, at the end of the world, people are going to be cast away. Look with me at verse 49. So shall it be at the end of the world, or the end of the age. So what age are we talking about? Are we talking about the church age? No. Are we talking about the Old Testament times? It's called Old Testament economy. No. The time that we're looking at here in this parable is what is called the tribulation time. So remember, the treasure in the field is Israel, and that treasure, it was reborn in 1948. I think it's May 14th. Then you had the pearl of great price, and it's going to grow and grow and grow, but ultimately, that pearl is going to be taken out. 1 Thessalonians 4, 1 Corinthians 15, John 14. It's been said that for every verse that predicted the first coming of Christ, there are 8 that predicts the second coming of Christ. There's not a one of us here tonight, there's probably not a one of us that are truly born again that ever question the first coming of Christ. We're getting ready to celebrate that first coming at Christmas. We'll talk about Bethlehem, and we'll talk about the baby Jesus, and we'll talk about the wise men and the shepherds and all of those things that happens every year at Christmas. But there are people in the world that do not believe that he came the first time. That's why we go to secular sources and we talk about the Lord Jesus. I was reading I was trying to clean my desk up a little bit today. My desk can get cluttered, all right? And Dr. Hudson, he had a remedy for that. What he would do is when you would go to see him at his office at the Sword of the Lord, when he was the editor there, he'd say, oh, come on in. And I mean, everything was pristine. And then he would say, you know, this is not really where I do my work. He said, if you want to see that, come here. And he would let you come over to a door and you would look, and there would be another office back there, and it had stuff everywhere. Well, I don't have but one office, and so I have stuff sometimes that's everywhere, all right? And so we have some clutter that's there, but you've got these tribulation saints that we're talking about. And I'll say more about that here in just a moment. But it's the gospel of Christ that will be preached during the tribulation period. Now, we're gone. The church is going to be taken out according to those portions of scripture I just gave to you. And so, this tribulation period, first of all, there are people that will be saved in great numbers during the tribulation period. I've had people say, will anybody be saved? Yeah, oh yeah, gonna be a lot of people be saved. Now, those that take the mark of the beast will not be, but there will be a great number that will not take that mark, and they will listen to the preaching that is going on. So I want you to look with me at Revelation 7, verse 9. Revelation 7, verse 9. And we'll also look at verse 14. And this I beheld, and lo, a great multitude, which no man could number, of all nations and kindreds and people and tongues or languages, stood before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed with white robes and palms or palm branches in their hands. Now look at verse 14, same chapter. And I said unto him, Sir, thou knowest. And he said to me, these are they which came out of the great tribulation and have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. And so there is a great, great number. These are those that came out of the great tribulation. So this is not church people. This is not the age in which we're living. This is not Old Testament saints. this is a group of people that is too many to number that are saved during the tribulation period. Now, there will be some that will not be saved during the tribulation. As a matter of fact, I think it probably depends really on who has heard the gospel and how many times they've heard the gospel before the Lord comes. But 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 talks about that for this cause God will send strong delusion that they will believe the lie. And so it could be that they have sinned away their day of grace, and when the tribulation happens, I've heard people say, well, I'm not going to get saved, but if I go into that tribulation, you better believe I'm going to get saved then. And I'm thinking, well, you might not. You may have that delusion that comes upon you. But there will be a group of people that have not heard from all these tribes, all of these nations, all of these different languages, and they're going to be standing around the throne, and it's those that came out of the tribulation, not the church age. Not only that, but there's going to be great persecution among these people. Look at Revelation 13, verse 7. And it was given unto him, the Antichrist, to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And power was given him over all kindreds, tongues, and nations. So there is going to be great persecution. Take the mark. No. And they get hammered. Some will lose their lives. They will be martyrs. That's why you read in Revelation about how long, O Lord? And those are the voices that are under the throne, and they're going, vengeance for us. And so we see that there's great persecution. For time's sake, we'll not go to Daniel 7:21, but that's another proof text. Now, these people are going to be saved by the preaching of two witnesses and by the 144,000 Jewish evangelists. We're not going to read all of this, but I've given you in your notes tonight, I've given you the address that you can look up when you get home. But Revelation 11, 1 through 13 talks about the two witnesses. They're going to die, they're going to raise again, but they will be preaching and people will be saved by their preaching. You've got the 144,000 Jewish evangelists. Now, I know that when the Jehovah Witnesses first began, they claimed that they were the 144,000. The problem was their numbers got larger than 144,000, so they had to change their doctrine. All right, and so the 144K, those are Jewish people. You say, how do you know that? Well, if you look at Revelation 7, which we don't have time really to do again tonight, but it talks about that there's 12,000 from each tribe. All right, that means that it's Jewish people that are doing the preaching. We don't come from, sometimes we say, well, that's my tribe, but that's kind of a loose definition of it. But when you look at the tribes in the Bible, we're thinking about the 12 tribes of Israel, that type of thing most often. And so we see that these people will be saved, and they're called tribulation saints because they're saved during that tribulation period. Now, I mentioned this just a second ago, but the culling will not be left to men. Now, the picture that these guys have seen, they know that they had pulled those nets to the shore. They know that they would go through them. They would keep the best ones, put them in baskets, and they would take them to the market, maybe at Magdala. They may take them down to Tiberias. They would take them to all these various cities around the shoreline of the Sea of Galilee. And by the way, I hope you know that the Sea of Galilee is not really a sea. There's nothing salt water about it at all. It is a fresh water lake. As a matter of fact, I think that Lake Lanier is probably bigger than the Sea of Galilee. It's like 12 by 7 miles in its length and width. And so it is the freshwater reservoir that really, I think they've kind of changed that a little bit. But used to, it was the place for fresh water for the whole nation. Now they have desalination plants. I think there's 4 or 5 of them that are where they get salt water from the Mediterranean. They take the salt out of it, and they can use that for what they call potable water. But the bottom line is that these men understood all of that process. But the Bible tells us that it's the angels. I want you to look with me that in verse 49, the second part of that, it says, so shall it be at the end of the world, or the end of the age, that the angels shall come forth. Right now, angels do not grab people, not in the way that it will be here. I think that sometimes angels take on forms. I am reading a book that that Buddy Thigpen asked me to read, and it's like 30 years in the making. And he was describing what was happening at the beginning of the book, and now he's talking about how God knows what he's doing, even though we don't always understand it. He said, you know, the sovereignty of God is beyond anybody. And so he was talking about his son when he was run over by the car. There was a lady that knelt down beside him, and supposedly she was an RN. He said, but to this day, that lady gave not only my son comfort, but she gave me comfort. And he said, and just as quickly as she came, she was gone. Now, theologically, I know that every time there's an appearance of an angel in the Bible, it's a masculine person. But I don't know if it's exclusive, except in the scripture, but it could be that that lady was just like us. Or it could be that God let her come on that scene for just that needed time. Now, doctrinally, I know that it's masculine. But I'm telling you, my friend at that point had somebody come along beside of him, and as quickly as she was there, she was gone. He doesn't know her name to this day, and that's been well over 30 years ago. And so you see that it's the angels that are going to come forth, and they are the ones that are going to sever the wicked from among the just. Look at verse 50. We see the casting. We've seen the culling. Now we're going to see the casting. After they have separated, they're putting the good into the vessels or to the baskets that's going to and the salvation part, be able to go to heaven and be righteous during the during the millennial. They will be in that basket. But the ones that are the bad, they shall be cast into the furnace of fire, and there shall be wailing and gnashing of teeth. Now, what is that a reference to? Well, I think that ultimately it's going to be a reference to the lake of fire. But there's also, I believe, a time that these people that are lost, that are going to be in the tribulation period at the end of it, that they will be taken and placed into hell. And so I want you to look with me at a couple of companion verses. I want you to look with me at Matthew 25, 31 to 46, and we'll just read and then I'll stop in a little bit. We're probably not going to go through all 15 verses. The Son of Man shall come in his glory, and all the holy angels with him, and he shall sit upon the throne of his glory. And before him shall be gathered all nations, and he shall separate them one from the other, as a shepherd divideth the sheep from the goats. He shall set the sheep on his right hand, but the goats on his left. And then shall the king say unto them on his right hand, come, ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom of God, prepared for you from the foundation of the world. Verse 35, for I was hungered, you gave me meat. Thirsty, you gave me drink. I was a stranger, you took me in. Naked, you clothed me. I was sick, you visited me not. I was in prison, and you came unto me. Verse 37, then shall a righteous answer him, saying, Lord, when saw we thee and hungered and fed thee, or thirsty and gave thee drink? When we saw thee and took a stranger and took thee in, or naked and clothed thee. Evidently, we're going to read all of it. When we saw thee sick or in prison or came unto thee. And the king shall answer and say unto them, verily I say unto you, inasmuch as you have done it unto one of the least of these, my brethren, you have done it unto me. I think about, when I read this, I think about during that tribulation, Just like there were people that hid Jews in World War II, I think there'll be people that hide Christians that come to Christ. When I say Christians, I'm talking about tribulation Christians. Then they come to Christ and they're running and trying to hide from basically the persecution that's coming down from Satan and the Antichrist. And so let's go to another verse, one more. Then he'll say to them on the left hand, depart from me, ye cursed, into everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels. And so that's enough for a proof text for that. You could go ahead and read through verse 46, but we'll not do that right now. You can also go back to chapter 13, and you can see in verse 41 and through 43, talks about the Son of Man will send forth his angels. They'll gather out of the kingdom all things that offend, and them which do iniquity, cast them into a furnace of fire, wailing and gnashing of teeth. And so you see the casting. You say, why do you use that phrase? Because that's the phrase that is used in the Bible. The net was cast into the sea. It was hurled into that sea. Verse 48, it talks about that the bad was cast away. And so you see the casting there. Verse 50, and shall cast them into the furnace of fire. And so there is a casting that takes place. Now, who do I think will be here at the end? When Jesus is about to begin the millennial reign, the tribulation is coming to an end at the Battle of Armageddon. When Armageddon is done, then it's time for the millennial to begin. Now, there's going to be many, many people that are going to be killed when they come against Israel, and the Lord comes out of heaven in Revelation 19, sharp sword goes out of his mouth, blood's going to be up to the horses' bridles. Now, I don't believe that that means it's going to be that deep, but I believe that the splatter is going to be as high up as the horses, probably their reins, their bridles. It's going to be a lot of bloodshed, all right? But there are going to be people that are killed, but then there will be other people, and the angels will take them and will cast them, hurl them into hell. You say, hell or lake of fire? I believe that at the end of the tribulation, they will be placed into Hades, the place of departed spirits. They will be there for the duration of the millennial reign of Christ. And after the millennial, they will be brought out, and that is called the resurrection of the dead. They will be brought out, and they will be set before what is called the great white throne judgment. And at the great white throne judgment, we read about that in Revelation 20. So let's go to Revelation 20, beginning in verse 10, and we'll go through verse 15. First of all, it says that the devil, this is not the Antichrist, this is the actual devil, Satan himself, that deceived them was cast into the lake of fire. That is the final destination for all the godless. For anyone that does not know Christ, that is the final destination. Hades, or hell as we know it, is only a temporary location, and that is where people are housed today. There is no one at this moment, biblically that I know of, that is in the lake of fire. All the damned are in the heart of the earth, in Hades. But one day, everything, every entity, every person that is in Hades will be brought out. They will be set at the great white throne. We'll see that in a second. Where the beast and the false prophet are. So the Antichrist, the false prophet, which is the false Holy Spirit, they are already in the lake of fire. The devil is now joining the other two, which make up the false Trinity. And they're going to be tormented day and night forever and ever. There will be no reprieve. There will be no escape. Verse 11. And this is where the damned that are in hell tonight and those that will be in hell after Armageddon, whether they died in Armageddon or whether the angels took them, and I don't know if they take their life or cast them whole into hell, but it says that I saw a great white throne and him that sat on it, from whose face the earth and the heaven fled away, and there was no place for them. I saw the dead, small and great, stand before God. The books were open, and another book was open, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged out of those things which were written in the books. In other words, there is a record that's going on, and in those books, the one thing that you do not find is you do not find them ever trusting Christ. Their names are not written in the Lamb's Book of Life. And so they are judged according to their works. That's all that they have, because they don't have the righteousness that Jesus gives. I got news for you. I'm glad it's the righteousness of Jesus and not my works that'll get me there. If it's not the works of Christ and none of mine, I have no hope, and neither do you. And so they're judged according to their works. Verse 14. And death and hell. So not only is the grave, but also hell, where all of those people were, every one of those were cast into the lake of fire. This is the second death. The first death is when they died and went to hell. This is the second death, which is eternal separation from God. Verse 15, and whosoever was not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire. So, 2 points to remember. The church is not in this parable. Boy, you talk about getting all confused. As Brother Don used to say, it'll confuse you as bad as a two-headed woodpecker in a rock quarry. This is not the church. Don't read the church into it. You remember, the treasure that was hidden in the field is Israel. The pearl of great price is the church. But ultimately, the draught of the catches of the fish that comes from the whole world is going to be drawn, and those that have trusted Christ during that tribulation will be saved, and those that rejected will be lost. So don't read the church into this parable. This is for Gentiles. It is not for church. It's not even for Old Testament saints, and it won't be for the nation of Israel that comes to Christ according to the book of Romans. There's going to be coming to the Lord, and that's the reason for the whole tribulation period, is to drive Israel into the arms of Messiah. Second thing, not just don't insert the church, but there will be no unsaved people that go into the millennium. Now let me give you one little caveat. There will be people that will be born during the millennium. Those people will have to trust Christ. All of them will not trust Christ. But if they are going to go into eternity as saints during that tribulation period, they are going to have to trust Christ. If they do not trust Christ, then they will be damned for all of eternity. And so you have the great white throne judgment, and after that, that's when the lake of fire begins to get its inhabitants. And so I hope tonight that maybe I've tried to maybe I've given you some things that maybe you've never thought of before. And so anyway, that's the net.